Happy Women's History Month. This is a very important Women's History Month because it's also the 100-year anniversary of women having the right to vote. That is, passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In case you didn't know, women did not get the right to vote when men did at the country's founding. Women had to fight for decades for the right to vote. And today, both voting rights and women's rights are under siege again from forces that are trying to control how loud their voices are. You may have heard me mention before that my great-great-aunt, Miriam Michelson, was a prominent reporter of the late 1800s and early 1900s, one of the rare, quote, girl reporters, and she personally kept the suffrage cause in the headlines with her relentless coverage of it. Her work helped get the 19th Amendment passed because it informed and motivated women about their right to vote. Today, we're going to hear from a prominent woman writer of today who has been writing about women's suffrage, women reporters, and women in the media for many years, and is a journalism professor at NYU. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility issues, energy, and sustainability. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts on greenconnectionsradio.com, which is our website, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. By the way, if you're struggling with your own career, let us know via Twitter or LinkedIn or our Contact Us page on our website, and we'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to help you out, no matter what industry you're in. You may see women anchors on television news or see women reporters in other news outlets and print, etc., see their names, but the fact of the matter is that women reporters are still, unfortunately, a rarity, especially in covering politics and business. The Women's Media Center reports that in 2019, men received 63% of bylines and other credits in print, internet, TV, and wire news, and women received only 37%. Let me say that another way. Women reporters only got credit for about one-third of the stories that men did. Representation of news management roles is worse, and representation of women reporters and editors of color is even worse. When it comes to reporting on politics, in print, 66% of bylines are male and 34% are female. Women still lead in the unfortunately pigeonholed categories of lifestyle, leisure, and health at 52% and 58%. During the suffrage movement, it was, of course, much, much worse. Women had few voices and platforms, as our guest today has addressed in depth in her groundbreaking special issue of American Journalism magazine. Women had to use the media in creative ways to achieve their voting rights goal, and like today, women needed and leveraged the support of men who believed women should have equal rights to men, including the right to vote. I'd like you to meet Brooke Kroeger, the author of several award-winning books, including The Suffragettes, How Women Used Men to Get the Vote, and a biography of legendary female investigative reporter Nellie Bly, called Nellie Bly, Daredevil Reporter and Feminist, who, in fact, was one of my inspirations to become a reporter. Brooke knows from the life of a reporter firsthand herself, having been a reporter and editor, including at Newsday and at UPI, United Press International. Today, Brooke is a professor of journalism at NYU Journalism Institute, which she previously led. I can go on, but you get the picture. I'm delighted to say that Brooke joins us live today in New York City from her amazing place. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Brooke, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So I'm going to jump right in. How did the suffrage movement leverage the media to get the 19th Amendment passed?
Well, my work focuses on that last decade, what I call the last lap of the movement, from about 1907-08 to 1919-20. And what happened in that period, after a long stretch, which was known as the doldrums, the movement stagnated for many, many years after its ostensible founding in 1840s. At that time, there was a huge change. So I talk about it as going from dowdy to dazzling. And the way the movement did that was by bringing in elites, both society, social women, and men of position, power, and influence. And many of them were publishers, editors, poets, writers, and had direct access to the levers of media. And of course, media was mostly newspapers and magazines. There really wasn't even radio till the 1920s. So, and if you think about it, with no television and no radio, magazines and newspapers played an enormous part in the entertainment and leisure life of everyone. So it was real influence in a way that we almost don't quite feel today.
So how did women leverage those levers? Did they, like my great aunt, seek to get published in them? Did they try to convince them to do stories? What was that actual interplay?
Well, I give the men probably more credit than anybody else will or ever will. I remember trying to get this book published, getting a lot of response like, who cares what the men did? A lot of that.
Wow.
But in fact, you know, the reason their participation in that last decade was so important was because they had the means to help financially, either through their wives or themselves, or they controlled the media, or they were the people who wrote for the media and were able to garner attention or assign women to work on those stories. Women weren't just doing it, they were being assigned. They were being assigned by people who were editors. The editors of the mainstream publications were men. The Congress was male. The voters, for the most part, except in the West, were men. So having access to men was an extremely important part of making a decision about what was going to happen.
You wouldn't get anywhere without them.
You would not get anywhere. That was the question I actually asked myself, was like, how could they have done this without the men? There just simply wasn't a way. So Oswald Garrison Villard, who was the editor and publisher of the New York Evening Post and The Nation magazine, a legacy from his father, proposed the idea to Anna Howard Shaw, who was the head of the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And he said, this was building on an idea that had already taken root in Europe, both in Holland and in England. And he said, we should do that here. You know, men should form an organization. And she wrote back and said, we've thought about this before, but it's always the wrong men who want to be engaged with us. They're the men full of isms, and we have enough women full of isms. We don't need to deal with that. He came back and he said, I really think I could put together an influential list. And of course, his initial idea was that they would troop up to Albany or to Washington and talk to their powerful legislative friends, or they would sign a letter, you know, something like that. So she thought about it again, and then she came back, and I tell this story often, and she said, okay, we've decided we'll do it, and we'll do all the back-end work, you know, typical response. And to his enormous credit, he said, no. He said, it's only going to be effective if we form our own organization. And they did.
Wow. Boy, there's so much to unpack in there. So the anti-suffragists, aka the anties, also used the media to try to keep the amendment from being passed.
Sure.
And they obviously had success for many years, right? So talk a little bit about what they did too. Did they do the same thing that the suffragists and the suffragettes did?
They didn't really have to, because they represented the status quo. They represented the prevailing viewpoints from the Victorian era and before, where it was expected that women would see home and hearth as first and take care for children. And so promoting those ideas were the ideas that many, many, if not most people.
Mm-hmm. So it was the normal coverage. Well, one of the things that I have learned from doing the book on my great aunt with Lori Harrison Kahn is that one of the arguments that the aunties made was that women didn't need the right to vote because they got it through their husbands. Of course, that assumes that all the women are married. Don't get me started on that one. But that plays into the power that men have.
Of course. But of course, there were also the women who were single and the women who were divorced and the women who were widowed, and, you know, where were they?
Right.
I found a picture yesterday in Leslie's magazine from 1913, a parade in Baltimore, where the women were marching in black veils so that their husbands couldn't identify them.
Oh, wow. That's a trip.
It's a great picture.
Why do you think it took so many decades to get the amendment passed if there was that much pressure and there were that many alliances?
Well, as I said before, there's this 50-year period where the movement is not moving. It was not moving, so there was that. The ideas had not taken hold except in the West. The West was far more effective at getting it through, but the West was not populous, and not as entrenched in social norms as the East was. So there was a lot more flexibility. Also, they had adopted Carrie Chapman Catt's strategy of going after the elites. So they had other ways of making things happen and were more open to women doing things. They also used arguments that were not, that didn't fly in the face of what people generally believed. So they had arguments that kind of went both ways, an argument that you could, that was hard to argue with.
So Miriam Michelson used fiction to get some of her points across, including to address sexual harassment and discrimination, yet she knew her male publishers would be loath to publish. How did other...
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay, good. I want to hear you disagree with that.
Well, I'm just thinking back to Nellie. I mean, the impetus for her madhouse incarceration were exactly these kinds of reports that were in the news.
When you say her madhouse incarceration, you mean when she got herself committed?
When she feigned insanity to go into Blackwell's Island's lunatic asylum for women.
That do investigative report.
Correct. That grew out of reports in the press just the previous month that there were abuses being committed against patients. So I don't think it was entirely.
Well, but that's abuses against patients. That's different than sexual harassment kinds of issues that are in normal life. Right? You could sort of put people who are in those institutions in a category, and you and I can talk about this a little bit more. But how did other women journalists of the era use fiction to get their messages across and to gain support? I mean, we still do that today. I mean, we have The Handmaid's Tale, we have Big Little Lies, right, which address domestic abuse, for example. But how did they, some of your work, from what I understand, is this issue of using media in different ways. So how did other women journalists of that era use fiction and use the media?
I'm trying to think who else was a fiction writer. I mean, in the decades that come after, there are some who moved to fiction writing. Martha Gellhorn wrote fiction, but they're quite a bit later. You know, offhand, I can't think of who was a fiction writer also.
Okay.
And I think in Miriam's case, she moved out of journalism into another form, correct?
Well, she did them both together for a while, and we can ask Lori about it later, but she did both of them together for a while and then moved more into fiction and then activism after a while.
So the activism thing interests me. You know, if you're looking at African-American women journalists of this period, they really didn't have a choice except to be in the activist press. They had to be in the black press because they didn't even have access to mainstream media for the most part. Suffrage women sort of moved back and forth a little bit. There were quite a few women who covered the suffrage movement. There's you know, some feeling that as soon as it became a front page story, the men then took over the story for the parades and stuff. They were writing those big main headers.
Because they were suddenly news, right?
Exactly.
Well, there was a lot of friction, obviously, between the white women and black women during the suffrage movement because from what I understand, black women wanted abolition to be part of the suffrage platform and to be included in it, and the white women felt that they would not get the amendment passed if they did that because they were appealing to basically white men who were lawmakers voting on
it. It was about the South. Okay. It was about the lawmakers in the South. So, I mean, it was about many things, but among the many things it was about getting Southern support, which they were not going to get because it would have doubled the black vote.
Well, and that goes back to the Constitution, too, where they didn't put it in because they felt they wouldn't get support from the black lawmakers in the South, right? Tell us about developing the suffrage and the media platform and the special issue of American Journalism Journal.
Oh, I love to talk about that. So when I was doing the book, I made a lot of friends with suffrage historians, women's historians of various kinds, mostly journalism historians, because that's sort of my world. And I put together this group of 10 fantastic women from all over the country. We met in March of 2017. American Journalism is a journal, an academic journal that comes out four times a year. I serve on the editorial board, as a number of people do. And I went to the editor and said, don't you think we should do a special suffrage issue because these anniversaries are coming up? He said, yes, we even have the funding for it. And it's going to take you 2 years. And, you know, I'm a wire service reporter. To me, like, you got to be kidding. It took the whole 2 years. It takes a long time to do an academic journal. And the group was fantastic. I mean, this is just like the greatest group. Anything you asked, everybody responded immediately. So we put out what's called a call for papers, and we got like 25 or 30 possibilities. We knew we were going to pick five. We did that. We went through the whole editing process. There was a lot of re-editing. And then the journal came out. At the same time, I felt it was important to find ways to take academic work and make it more popular, especially because this subject was going to be important. So being a media person, I said, let's create a database of not only the academic articles, but the exhibitions and everything, the videos, anything anybody's doing about suffrage. So we got funding from the New York Humanities.
Oh.
And my department created the site. It's really beautiful. It's called suffrageandthemedia.org. And it has the best search engine you've ever seen. I mean, it's fantastic. So everything is organized by academic, popular, essay, TV program, video, whatever. You can put in all those notes and find what you like. And it's quite easy to run, but we keep loading it. And we said we'd load it through 2020. And we do that.
Is it multimedia?
Yeah, it has everything on it. I mean, it's got, it'll...
Oh, radio, it'll even have radio and podcast?
It'll carry anything that we put up.
How did you decide what to include? You said you got 25, 30 papers and you chose five. What were you looking for and how to decide what to put on?
We were looking for unexamined issues where we could bring a fresh idea. And then, so those five papers came, the journal came out. And then we thought, oh, we would take it to a book publisher. And the book publisher wanted us to do all new essays. So that book has just come out. And that's called Front Pages, Front Lines. It's academic. I need to be really clear about that. And it includes 12 essays, only three of which were in the original journal. And so they're all brand new. And they deal with many of the under-examined subjects, including African American women in the movement. We have like four pieces that deal with that subject.
Who is the audience for the platform, and who is the audience for, well, the academic journal, I guess, is targeted to academics.
Of course.
But who is the platform for, and who is Front Lines, Front Page for?
Front Pages, Front Lines is really, it's for scholars, I think, or people who are interested in the subject in a deep and noted, footnoted, you know,
in-depth something.
Right. Exactly. The platform, Suffrage in the Media, is for everybody. So if you want, you can find links to academic material. If you want to do stuff that's more fun or exhibitions, it's all on there. So it's for everybody. It's for a teaching tool. It's for just every possible use to make the subject broad.
And I gather you can search by name of people and things like that.
Everything.
That's great. Perfect. So... before I ask you about your career advice, I want to ask you a little bit about the issue of men. And we talked a little bit about this, but there were male legislators who had to give women the right to vote one state at a time. And as I understand, it was neck and neck in the last state in Tennessee. You wrote, in the Suffragettes, you talk about that. And you talk about the male publishers, et cetera. But talk about the male lawmakers and how the women persuaded, cajoled, begged, whatever it was, the male lawmakers to pass.
You know, there's so many ways to talk about how did this finally come to pass after 70 years. I mean, how did they finally bring it together? And I think there was a confluence of forces that made this happen. So some people would tell you that it was Alice Paul and her National Women's Party and their agitation and their silent sentinels and their protests and their hunger strikes and their jailings, etc. Some would disagree with that. Some would say it was Wilson's finally coming around, finally. And why was Wilson able to come around? Because New York had voted, bringing 44 seats into Congress. Suddenly there was critical mass in Congress where there was a way to counter the opposition from the South. That was important. But also very important was World War I, that the sacrifices that women were making were so heartfelt and so important. They were losing their sons, they were losing their husbands, they were doing war work at an extraordinary level, that it was at this point very, very hard to say you're a citizen who can't have the rights of citizenship.
Did the protests in front of the White House against Nixon, against Wilson when he was resisting this play a role?
As I said, I think all of these things played a part, but there was so much opposition within the movement itself about what Alice Paul and crew were doing, and especially at the time that New York was trying to pass suffrage in the state, that the women of New York, who were very, very important to the movement was headquartered in New York, were very upset about what was happening in Washington. Hmm. And yet both of them were running lobbying forces in Congress. They were both working on...
For the same goal.
For the same goal.
So... One quick career question for you, and then we'll get to some advice. Tell us about your decision to become a journalist and then your decision to shift more into teaching and writing about journalism.
Well, I was a journalist for a really long time, mostly abroad. I was a correspondent in Brussels, London, Tel Aviv, and then London again as chief editor for a failing company, which is When Women Get Opportunity. And then I moved to the States, and I went to work for Newsday, and I did that for 2 years. It was not my favorite job. And I wrote for magazines for a couple of years, and then I got a book idea, which was the Nellie Bly book, thanks to my daughter, whose idea it was, because she also was my childhood hero. And then I loved doing that, so I wrote one book, and then I wrote another book, and then I saw an ad in the paper for a position at NYU. And I thought, I could do that. So I sent them a letter and then went through innumerable processes but became a professor. And so I've done that for the last 22 years. And the great thing about being a professor is you can continue to be a journalist and you can continue to write books. And you get the joy of teaching brilliant young students.
Oh, that's interesting. So you basically just applied cold. You didn't know anybody at NYU?
Well, it was an ad for a chair of the department, and I just thought I could do that. And, of course, they wrote back and said, we're not going to consider you for chair because you've never taught. They said, but we have a visiting position that we'd like you to apply for. And so I did that, and then the rest is history.
Oh, I love that. Well, that's a great inspiration because everybody thinks you only can get in with connections, and I love stories like that.
I've never had a connection for anything I have done in my life, which is not true of most women journalists, we find.
Exactly.
They usually do have connections.
Well, now you have a connection with me, at least. So what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career, whatever that feels like, who wants to use her education, her experience, and her passion for making a difference in her career? She wants to make money, she wants to get ahead, she's ambitious. But what would you say to her? So it's not a kid fresh out of college, but somebody who's maybe at least 10, 15 years of experience, maybe more, who really wants to use who she is and what she knows how to do to make a difference and make money.
For me, teaching at a university level has been that. I don't think that was my goal. I think when I went to graduate school, I thought I have, enough energy to get through an MA, and I'm just going to do that. And I thought someday I might want to teach, and it's a terminal degree in journalism, so I thought, okay, I'll just have this. And then I forgot all about that for, 25 years or longer. And then when I saw that ad, I thought, I always wanted to do that. And it seemed like the point where you'd be giving back. So I guess that's just my experience. And I think you find it when, you know, you see that ad or whatever the equivalent is that says, oh, yes, that would fulfill all those goals.
So that's a good point. Basically, what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is you'll feel the next step when it shows up and there's a resonance with what feels right as you explore different opportunities. Am I getting that right?
I think so. I guess so. It's life has come to me that way.
Right.
And kind of in decades, you know, in 10-year or 20-year spurts, it's come that way.
Well, I find that so many people think they have to plan for their next, and it's like, yeah, but be present where you are. Do what you're doing now and then see. Yeah.
I did the last planning at 22 and everything has come true. Everything has happened just like I planned it.
Oh, that's great, and that's a great line to end on as well. So thank you so much
You're
for
welcome.
Joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Brooke Kroeger, journalist and author of many books on women, suffrage, and the media, and including The Suffragettes. I love that title. So who was your favorite female reporter? How do you think female reporters are doing today? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page. Find us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else, and leave us a review if you would, or on our website at greenconnectionsradio.com, wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you for joining us. I'm Joan Michelson. See you next time.
Thank you.
That was terrible. It was not good. It's a Zoom recorder. Yeah, it's an H4N.
I just got the 6.
And yes, we are recording.
Hi. I'm Brooke Kroeger. It's March 5th.
There you go.
We just had a wonderful lunch.
Thank you. You might be a little bit louder coming forward, but that's okay. Okay? No clanging of dishes on tables? Happy Women's History Month. This is a very important Women's History Month because it's also the 100-year anniversary of women having the right to vote. That is, passage of the 19th Amendment to the Constitution. In case you didn't, let me just, hang on a second. I'm going to back this up on my phone.
That's a good idea.
I always like Plan B. Happy Women's History Month. This is a very important Women's History Month because it's also the 100-year anniversary of women having the right to vote. That is, passage of the 19th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. In case you didn't know, women did not get the right to vote when men did at the country's founding. Women had to fight for decades for the right to vote. And today, both voting rights and women's rights are under siege again from forces that are trying to control how loud their voices are. You may have heard me mention before that my great-great-aunt, Miriam Michelson, was a prominent reporter of the late 1800s and early 1900s, one of the rare, quote, girl reporters, and she personally kept the suffrage cause in the headlines with her relentless coverage of it. Her work helped get the 19th Amendment passed because it informed and motivated women about their right to vote. Today, we're going to hear from a prominent woman writer of today who has been writing about women's suffrage, women reporters, and women in the media for many years, and is a journalism professor at NYU. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, where we bring you insights and tips from remarkably innovative women about corporate responsibility issues, energy, and sustainability. I'm Joan Michelson. We talk about innovation, leadership, technologies, and careers, always bringing a new perspective. Find us anywhere you like to listen to podcasts on greenconnectionsradio.com, which is our website, and through my Forbes blog as well. And please pass it on to your friends. By the way, if you're struggling with your own career, let us know via Twitter or LinkedIn or our Contact Us page on our website, and we'll help you with contacts, resources, strategies, ideas, and tips to help you out, no matter what industry you're in. You may see women anchors on television news or see women reporters in other news outlets and print, etc., see their names, but the fact of the matter is that women reporters are still, unfortunately, a rarity, especially in covering politics and business. The Women's Media Center reports that in 2019, men received 63% of bylines and other credits in print, internet, TV, and wire news, and women received only 37%. Let me say that another way. Women reporters only got credit for about one-third of the stories that men did. Representation of news management roles is worse, and representation of women reporters and editors of color is even worse. When it comes to reporting on politics, in print, 66% of bylines are male and 34% are female. Women still lead in the unfortunately pigeonholed categories of lifestyle, leisure, and health at 52% and 58%. During the suffrage movement, it was, of course, much, much worse. Women had few voices and platforms, as our guest today has addressed in depth in her groundbreaking special issue of American Journalism magazine. Women had to use the media in creative ways to achieve their voting rights goal, and like today, women needed and leveraged the support of men who believed women should have equal rights to men, including the right to vote. I'd like you to meet Brooke Kroeger, the author of several award-winning books, including The Suffragettes, How Women Used Men to Get the Vote, and a biography of legendary female investigative reporter Nellie Bly called Nellie Bly, Daredevil Reporter and Feminist, who in fact was one of my inspirations to become a reporter. Brooke knows from the life of a reporter firsthand herself, having been a reporter and editor, including at Newsday and at UPI, United Press International. Today, Brooke is a professor of journalism at NYU Journalism Institute, which she previously led. I can go on, but you get the picture. I'm delighted to say that Brooke joins us live today in New York City from her amazing place. Welcome to Green Connections Radio, Brooke, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
So I'm going to jump right in. How did the suffrage movement leverage the media to get the 19th Amendment passed?
Well, my work focuses on that last decade, what I call the last lap of the movement, from about 1907-08 to 1919-20. And what happened in that period, after a long stretch, which was known as the doldrums, the movement stagnated for many, many years after its ostensible founding in the 1840s. At that time, there was a huge change. So I talk about it as going from dowdy to dazzling. And the way the movement did that was by bringing in elites, both society, social women, and men of position, power, and influence. And many of them were publishers, editors, poets, writers, and had direct access to the levers of media. And of course, media was mostly newspapers and magazines. There really wasn't even radio till the 1920s. So, and if you think about it, with no television and no radio, magazines and newspapers played an enormous part in the entertainment and leisure life of everyone. So it was real influence in a way that we almost don't quite feel today.
So how did women leverage those levers? Did they, like my great aunt, seek to get published in them? Did they try to convince them to do stories? What was that actual interplay?
Well, you know, I give the men probably more credit than anybody else will or ever will. I remember trying to get this book published, getting a lot of response like, who cares what the men did? A lot of that.
Wow.
But in fact, you know, the reason their participation in that last decade was so important was because they had the means to help financially, either through their wives or themselves, or they controlled the media, or they were the people who wrote for the media and were able to garner attention or assign women to work on those stories. Women weren't just doing it. They were being assigned. They were being assigned by people who were editors. The editors of the mainstream publications were men. The Congress was male. The voters, for the most part, except in the West, were men. So having access to men was an extremely important part of making a decision about what was going to happen.
You wouldn't get anywhere without them.
You would not get anywhere. That was the question I actually asked myself. It was like, how could they have done this without the men? There just simply wasn't a way. So Oswald Garrison Villard, who was the editor and publisher of the New York Evening Post and The Nation magazine, a legacy from his father, proposed the idea to Anna Howard Shaw, who was the head of the National American Women's Suffrage Association. And he said, this was building on an idea that had already taken root in Europe, both in Holland and in England. And he said, we should do that here. You know, men should form an organization. And she wrote back and said, we've thought about this before, but it's always the wrong men who want to be engaged with us. They're the men full of isms, and we have enough women full of isms. We don't need to deal with that. He came back and he said, I really think I could put together an influential list. And of course, his initial idea was that they would troop up to Albany or to Washington and talk to their powerful legislative friends, or they would sign a letter, you know, something like that. So she thought about it again, and then she came back. I tell this story often, and she said, okay, we've decided we'll do it, and we'll do all the back-end work, you know, typical response. And to his enormous credit, he said, no. He said, it's only going to be effective if we form our own organization. And they did.
Wow. Boy, there's so much to unpack in there. So the anti-suffragists, a.k.a. the antis, also used the media to try to keep the amendment from being passed.
Sure.
And they obviously had success for many years, right? So talk a little bit about what they did too. Did they do the same thing that the suffragists and the suffragettes did?
They didn't really have to, because they represented the status quo. They represented the prevailing viewpoints from the Victorian era and before, where it was expected that women would see home and hearth as first and take care for children. And so promoting those ideas were the ideas that many, many, if not most people.
Mm-hmm. So it was the normal coverage. Well, one of the things that I have learned from doing the book on my great aunt with Lori Harrison Kahn is that one of the arguments that the aunties made was that women didn't need the right to vote because they got it through their husbands. Of course, that assumes that all the women are married. Let me start on that one. But that plays into the power that men have.
Of course. But of course, there were also the women who were single and the women who were divorced and the women who were widowed, and you know, where were they?
Right.
I found a picture yesterday in Leslie's magazine from 1913 of a parade in Baltimore where the women were marching in black veils so that their husbands couldn't identify them.
Oh, wow. That's a trip.
It's a great picture.
Why do you think it took so many decades to get the amendment passed if there was that much pressure and there were that many alliances?
Well, as I said before, there's this 50-year period where the movement is not moving. It was not moving, so there was that. The ideas had not taken hold except in the West. The West was far more effective at getting it through, but the West was not populous, and so and not as entrenched in social norms as the East was. So there was a lot more flexibility. Also, they had adopted Carrie Chapman Catt's strategy of going after the elites. So they had other ways of making things happen and were more open to women doing things. They also used arguments that were not, that didn't fly in the face of what people generally believed. So they had arguments that kind of went both ways, argument that you could, that was hard to argue with.
Give us an example.
I'm trying to think, like, I'm going to get this all wrong, I'm afraid, but the justice argument was that women have the right, you have to give it to them, that sort of thing, rather than women can, I'm going to mess this up, I have to look it up,
Okay. So Miriam Michelson used fiction to get some of her points across, including to address sexual harassment and discrimination that she knew her male publishers would be loath to publish. How did other...
I'm not sure I agree with that.
Okay, good. I want to disagree with that. Disagree with that.
Well, I'm just thinking back to Nellie. I mean, the impetus for her madhouse incarceration were exactly these kinds of reports that were in the news.
When you say her madhouse incarceration, you mean when she got herself committed?
When she feigned insanity to go into Blackwell's Island's lunatic asylum for women.
To do investigative reporting.
Correct. That grew out of reports in the press just the previous month that there were abuses being committed against patients. So I don't think it was entirely.
Well, but that's abuses against patients. That's different than sexual harassment kinds of issues that are in normal life. Right? You could sort of put people who are in those institutions in a category, and you and I can talk about this a little bit more. But how did other women journalists of the era use fiction to get their messages across and to gain support? I mean, we still do that today. I mean, we have The Handmaid's Tale, we have Big Little Lies, right, which address domestic abuse, for example. But how did they, some of your work, from what I understand, is this issue of using media in different ways. So how did other women journalists of that era use fiction and use the media?
I'm trying to think who else was a fiction writer. I mean, in the decades that come after, there are some who moved to fiction writing. Martha Gellhorn wrote fiction, but they're quite a bit later. You know, offhand, I can't think of who was a fiction writer also.
Okay.
And I think in Miriam's case, she moved out of journalism into another form, correct?
Well, she did them both together for a while, and we can ask Laurie about it later, but she did both of them together for a while and then moved more into fiction and then activism after a while.
So the activism thing interests me. You know, if you're looking at African-American women journalists of this period, they really didn't have a choice except to be in the activist press. They had to be in the black press because they didn't even have access to mainstream media for the most part. Suffrage women sort of moved back and forth a little bit. There were quite a few women who covered the suffrage movement. There's you know, some feeling that as soon as it became a front page story, the men then took over the story for the parades and stuff. They were writing those big main headers.
Because they were suddenly news, right?
Exactly.
Well, there was a lot of friction, obviously, between the white women and black women during the suffrage movement, because from what I understand, black women wanted abolition to be part of the suffrage platform and to be included in it, and the white women felt that they would not get the amendment passed if they did that because they were appealing to basically white men who were lawmakers voting.
It was about the South. Okay. It was about the lawmakers in the South. So, I mean, it was about many things, but among the many things it was about getting Southern support, which they were not going to get because it would have doubled the black vote.
Well, and that goes back to the Constitution, too, where they didn't put it in because they felt they wouldn't get support from the black lawmakers in the South, right? Tell us about developing the suffrage and the media platform that you developed in the special issue of American Journalism magazine.
So it's not a magazine, it's an academic journal.
Okay. Okay.
It's okay. Like, it's really not a magazine.
Well, okay. I'll rephrase it. Tell us about developing. Take two for my editor.
Thank you.
Tell us about developing the suffrage and the media platform and the special issue of American Journalism Journal.
Oh, I'd love to talk about that. So, when I was doing the book, I made a lot of friends with suffrage historians, women's historians of various kinds. Mostly journalism historians, because that's sort of my world. And I put together this group of 10 fantastic women from all over the country. We met in March of 2017. American Journalism is a journal, an academic journal that comes out 4 times a year. I serve on the editorial board, as a number of people do. And I went to the editor and said, don't you think we should do a special suffrage issue because these anniversaries are coming up? He said, yes, we even have the funding for it, and it's going to take you 2 years. And, you know, I'm a wire service reporter. To me, like, you got to be kidding. It took the whole 2 years. It takes a long time to do an academic journal. And the group was fantastic. And this was just, like, the greatest group. Anything you asked, everybody responded immediately. So we put out what's called a call for papers, and we got, like, 25 or 30 possibilities. We knew we were going to pick 5. We did that. We went through the whole editing process. There was a lot of re-editing. And then the journal came out. At the same time, I felt it was important to find ways to take academic work and make it more popular, especially because this subject was going to be important. So being a media person, I said, let's create a database of not only the academic articles, but the exhibitions and everything, the videos, anything anybody's doing about suffrage. So we got funding from the New York Humanities.
Oh.
And my department created the site. It's really beautiful. It's called suffrageandthemedia.org. And it has the best search engine you've ever seen. I mean, it's fantastic. So everything is organized by academic, popular, essay, TV program, video, whatever. You can put in all those notes and find what you like. And it's quite easy to run, but we keep loading it. And we said we'd load it through 2020. And we do that.
Is it multimedia?
Yeah, it has everything on it. I mean, it's got...
It'll even have radio and podcast.
Yeah, it'll carry anything that we put up.
How did you decide what to include? You said you got 25, 30 papers and you chose five. What were you looking for and how to decide what to put on?
We were looking for unexamined issues where we could bring a fresh idea. And then, so those five papers came, the journal came out. And then we thought, oh, we would take it to a book publisher. And the book publisher wanted us to do all new essays. So that book has just come out, and that's called Front Pages, Front Lines. It's academic. I need to be really clear about that. And it includes 12 essays, only three of which were in the original journal. And so they're all brand new, and they deal with many of the under-examined subjects, including African American women in the movement. We have like four pieces that deal with that subject.
Who is the audience for the platform and who is the audience for, well, the academic journal, I guess, is targeted to academics.
Of course.
But who is the platform for and who is Front Lines Front Page for?
Front Pages Front Lines is really, it's for scholars, I think, or people who are interested in the subject in a deep and noted, footnoted, you know,
in-depth
way.
Something, right.
Exactly. The platform, Suffrage in the Media, is for everybody. So if you want, you can find links to academic material. If you want to do stuff that's more fun or exhibitions, it's all on there. So it's for everybody. It's for a teaching tool. It's for just every possible use to make the subject broad.
And I gather you can search by name of people and things like that,
everything.
Too. That's great. Perfect. So... before I ask you about your career advice, I want to ask you a little bit about the issue of men. And we talked a little bit about this, but there were male legislators who had to give women the right to vote one state at a time. And as I understand, it was neck and neck in the last state in Tennessee. You wrote, in the Suffragettes, you talk about that. How did they focus on, you talk about the male publishers, et cetera, but talk about the male lawmakers and how the women persuaded, cajoled, begged, whatever it was, the male lawmakers to pass.
You know, there's so many ways to talk about how did this finally come to pass after 70 years. I mean, how did they finally bring it together? And I think there was a confluence of forces that made this happen. So some people would tell you that it was Alice Paul and her National Women's Party and their agitation and their silent sentinels and their protests and their hunger strikes and their jailings, etc. Some would disagree with that. Some would say it was Wilson's finally coming around, finally. And why was Wilson able to come around? Because New York had voted, bringing 44 seats into Congress. Suddenly there was critical mass in Congress where there was a way to counter the opposition from the South. That was important. But also very important was World War I, that the sacrifices that women were making were so heartfelt and so important. They were losing their sons. They were losing their husbands. They were doing war work at an extraordinary level, that it was at this point very, very hard to say you're a citizen who can't have the rights of citizenship.
Did the protests in front of the White House against Nixon, against Wilson when he was resisting this play a role?
As I said, I think all of these things played a part, but there was so much opposition within the movement itself about what Alice Paul and crew were doing. Right. And especially at the time that New York was trying to pass suffrage in the state, that the women of New York, who were very, very important to the movement was headquartered in New York, were very upset about what was happening in Washington. Hmm. And yet both of them were running lobbying forces in Congress. They were both working on.
For the same goal.
For the same goal.
So
different approaches.
One quick career question for you, and then we'll get to some advice. Tell us about your decision to become a journalist and then your decision to shift more into teaching and writing about journalism.
Well, I was a journalist for a really long time, mostly abroad. I was a correspondent in Brussels, London, Tel Aviv, and then London again as chief editor for a failing company, which is When Women Get Opportunity. And then I moved to the States and I went to work for Newsday. And I did that for 2 years. It was not my favorite job. And I wrote for magazines for a couple of years. And then I got a book idea, which was the Nellie Bly book, thanks to my daughter, whose idea it was, because she also was my childhood hero. And then I loved doing that. So I wrote one book, and then I wrote another book. And then I saw an ad in the paper for a position at NYU. And I thought, I could do that. So I sent them a letter, and then went through innumerable processes, but became a professor. And so I've done that for the last 22 years. And the great thing about being a professor is you can continue to be a journalist, and you can continue to write books. And you get the joy of teaching brilliant young students.
Oh, that's interesting. So you basically just applied cold. You didn't know anybody
cold.
At NYU?
Well, you know, it was an ad for a chair of the department, and I just thought, I could do that. And of course, they went back and said, we're not going to consider you for chair because you've never taught. They said, but we have a visiting position that we'd like you to apply for. And so I did that, and then the rest is history.
Oh, I love that. Well, that's a great inspiration because everybody thinks you only can get in with connections, and I love stories like
I've
that.
I've never had a connection for anything I've done in my life, which is not true of most women journalists, we find.
Exactly,
they do
that's
have
true. Well, now you have a connection with me, at least.
There you go.
So what would you suggest to a woman in mid-career, whatever that feels like, who wants to use her education, her experience, and her passion for making a difference in her career? She wants to make money. She wants to get ahead. She's ambitious. But what would you say to her? So it's not a kid fresh out of college, but somebody who's maybe at least 10, 15 years of experience, maybe more, who really wants to use who she is and what she knows how to do to make a difference and make money.
For me, teaching at a university level has been that. I don't think that was my goal. I think when I went to graduate school, I thought I have, you know, enough energy to get through an MA and I'm just going to do that. And I thought someday I might want to teach, and it's a terminal degree in journalism. So I thought, okay, I'll just have this. And then I forgot all about that for, you know, 25 years or longer. And then when I saw that ad, I thought, I always wanted to do that. And it seemed like the point where you'd be giving back. So I guess that's just my experience. And I think you find it when, you know, you see that ad or whatever the equivalent is that says, oh, yes, that would fulfill all those goals.
So that's a good point. Basically what you're saying, if I'm hearing you right, is you'll feel the next step when it shows up. There's a resonance with what feels right as you explore different opportunities. Am I getting that right?
I think so. I guess so. It's yeah. Life has come to me that way.
Right.
And kind of in decades, you know, in right. 10-year or 20-year spurts, it's come that way.
Well, I find that so many people think they have to plan for their next, and it's like, yeah, but be present where you are. Do what you're doing now and then see.
Yeah, I did the last planning at 22. everything has come true. Everything has happened just like I planned it.
Oh, that's great. And that's a great line to end on as well. So thank you so much for joining us today on Green Connections Radio. Brooke Kroeger, journalist and author of many books on women, suffrage in the media, and including the Suffragettes. I love that title. So who was your favorite female reporter? How do you think female reporters are doing today? Tweet it to us at Joan Michelson or post it on our Facebook page. Find us on Apple Podcasts or anywhere else and leave us a review if you would. or on our website at greenconnectionsradio.com, wherever you like to listen to your favorite podcasts. Thank you for joining us. I'm Joan Michelson. See you next time.